and politics. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
And that brings me to the last question. You kind of led off the end with the question of how do we build structures that can win? We have to stop thinking about organization as something like a process of construction. We use these construction metaphors, and it's shorthand talk, but we're talking about human beings here. We're talking about getting human beings involved in being together when they're not used to being together, when everything about capitalism is pushing people apart into isolated modes of existence. And, of course, the social industry plays a role in that, too, because why bother meeting people in person when you can make seemingly intense friendships on the internet and go a bit mad in the process? I think a good starting point would be anything that gets people together, working together on a common cause. I say anything. I don't obviously include in that pogroms and, you know, stuff like that. I think we have to think about how when people are drawn out into these pogroms, they're being offered a simulacrum of solidarity. There was a recent pogrom in Ballymena, where I lived for a period of time, and I know the place very well, and it was against asylum seekers after a sexual assault. Northern Ireland has some of the worst sexual assault rates in Europe, some of the worst femicide rates in Europe. If they were going to riot every time there was a sexual assault, Northern Ireland would burn to the ground. And maybe it should burn to the ground, but obviously they only come out whenever the alleged suspect is an asylum seeker. What struck me was remembering how whenever I had lived in Northern Ireland, when the loyalists would go out to smash Catholic windows and so on, that there was a sense of, you know, come on, boys, here we go. We can, you know, it was a sense of solidarity, of being in it together, even if it would only last for the evening. And quite often it had a sense of a nebulous sort of rebelliousness against the police and so on. Obviously, it's a horrible, vicious, go-nowhere kind of politics. As I say, it's a symptom that exists so that you don't have to come up with a solution. But if we can offer something better than a simulacrum of solidarity, we'll be making a start. Sorry, I've gone on a bit. We'll take more questions. You know, you ask about the particular conditions in those countries that are affected by what I'm calling disaster nationalism, because obviously there are some countries that aren't undergoing anything like this kind of rupture. And also it would be important to distinguish what I'm talking about from more classical top-down authoritarianism, like, for example, in the PRC, which, though nationalistic, doesn't have the same dynamics. And I suppose we could talk about what distinguishes, say, somewhere like Chile, where the far right is growing, but the left still seems to be ahead, from somewhere like Argentina, where you've got an outright far right government. I think there are a few things that you can see in common, but it's important to segment the problem a little bit, because in the, you know, like we often get stuff about globalism and all the rest of it. That is a discourse of the global north. You don't hear that in the Philippines or in India or in Brazil or in Argentina. That is not a discourse of the global south. That is a discourse of relative imperial decline. It's a panic that the living standards of the West are being drained or they're losing ground relative to China and so on. But if you pay attention to what someone like Duterte said, he attacked protectionism, Bolsonaro straight up neoliberal in the most aggressive sense. So there's a kind of segmentation here between one form of far right, which is an excrescence of decline, and another form of far-right, which is an expression of a frustrated, upwardly mobile, middle-income country that wants to be a lot better off than it is. Or rather, it'd be better to talk about how the middle class of that country aspires for it to be wealthier than it really is. And, quite often they look at China and they think, why are we not like China? I think that you can see some aspects in common between countries of the global south, which are upwardly mobile, middle-income countries that have been frustrated, that haven't grown as quickly as they wanted to. Then you can talk about countries in the east of Europe, which used to belong to the Eastern Bloc. In that case, a lot of what has happened, of course, we all know about shock therapy and the sort of social and civic collapse that that brought about, and the ongoing dialectic between a kind of neoliberal politics, which doesn't deliver for anybody, and an authoritarian retrenchment. One of the things that happens in those societies, however, is that the symptoms, the problems of their societies are blamed still on a lingering kind of communism. It's really interesting here because in those societies where communists are, you know, least evident, where there's very little evidence of any kind of historically organized communist force remaining, that you get the anti-communist discourse much more virulent than elsewhere. Like, for example, in India, where there still is some form of historical communism, it plays a much lesser role. What I want to say about that is that they decided in the 1990s that the communists had never really abandoned their posts, that they still controlled the teachers, they still controlled the judges, they still had control of the courts and the media institutions, and they had shifted strategy towards things like, you know, gay rights, vegetarianism, bicyclist rights, all that kind of stuff. And concurrently, of course, that lent itself to anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about George Soros, which became particularly important not when it first erupted in the 1990s, but after the 2008 credit crunch and all the symptoms that unfolded from that. What I'm saying is that there's no one set of conditions that applies to them all, because if it was simply a case of neoliberalism, frankly, every country would be affected by that. The neoliberal attack on democracy, attack on social organization, the attack on social welfare, all the rest of it, a very important and necessary precondition for this kind of politics. But there are a number of historically contingent causes as well that affect different parts of the world in different ways. The other question about, well, it wasn't really a question, it was a contribution, to be fair. I think the question really, if you could put it like that, is where do we have agency? And talking about how in New York, a number of working class people, migrants, women of color, and so on, who would never have voted Trump before, started to talk about Trump in 2024. And obviously, I agree that it's necessary to differentiate the Trump audience, the hard right, versus the people who are voting in rejection of the status quo, people who are won over on stuff like anti-abortion or homophobia or whatever it happens to be. The question of what's attracting people is very different, but if it does come down to the question of we don't feel we have any agency, we feel a bit desperate, and the Democrats don't respect us and they don't listen to us and they don't ask from a great height, where do we have real agency here? And, of course, I agree that the trade unions are going to be extremely important. And it's not just because of, you know, winning bread and butter struggles, but it's because of subject formation, a kind of collective identity. And I think that's very important. Of course, you very recently saw a reversal of that pattern in New York, where Zoran Mamdani picked up huge numbers of people who had previously voted Trump, deliberately. Now, I know that you get arguments which would say, well, that's because he had a very disciplined focus on economic issues. And I would say, yeah, that's true, up to a point. Part of the myth here that I want to bust is the idea that there's some necessary distinction between, to put it one way, the politics of economic justice and the politics of recognition. What Mamdani did was very interesting. He talked about all the material stuff that people are interested in. He also made an effort to talk to people in their own languages, which I think was quite important. And also, really importantly, if you're going to get people rallying behind a campaign and a candidate they've never seen before, they need to believe that candidate will be a fighter. They need to believe that candidate's not going to chicken out at the last minute and abandon them and throw them under the bus. There's been various criticisms of Mamdani in that campaign, but I would say that most of his concessions to the dominant discourse were rhetorical, tactical, that he stuck to his guns, particularly when he was attacked on issues to do with Palestine, issues to do with racism, his identity. So I think partly building up trust by being a fighter or showing combativity will mean that people will be drawn in to support you and be willing to get involved in some sort of activity. And that's just on the electoral side. But I think you know, more generally, that could apply to forms of political organization. Okay, quickly, John, one of the things that has happened here, I think you're right that January 6th was much more effective for the right than we realized at the time. I think one of the things, when you say it exhausted the liberals and they took their best shot, is they actually decided not to take their best shot. They backed off from it. For example, Donald Trump, they made no serious effort to go after him. I mean, there were prosecutions and what have you, but really, the guy should have been in jail already before he was running. And when you look at how they dealt with January 6th, they said things like the system held, but barely. And what they did about it was they focused on locking up individuals. Now, I'm not against locking up individuals who are fascists and what have you and represent a serious threat to public safety and all the rest of it. This side of abolition, I think that's common sense. But that's not going to undo the institutional weaknesses that you face. When you've got a Supreme Court that is over several generations being shifted towards increasingly the radical right, when you've got the radical right, starting with the Tea Party, colonizing local state apparatuses, essentially, you would want to be looking at major constitutional reform if you're going to have the wherewithal to deal with some of these problems. And I think one of the problems for the Democrats is they hate the idea of giving people ideas above their station. They hate the idea of encouraging people to think that they can achieve radical reforms that would go beyond what they want to achieve. So I think that there was a self-limiting dynamic in what the Democrats and the Liberals actually did about Trump once they had power, once they had office again. Is there a lesson for us in terms of the fact that Trump is much more aggressive this time around? Is there a lesson for what we can do and what we can apply? I would say one thing about that is that over the last few years, when the far right has won office, it's been a process, a pedagogical process, punctuated by moments of, projecting influence, often well ahead of their real social depth, and gaining results, and they're not doing very much with it at first. And I think what's happened with the Trump guys is they learned on the job. They learned where their weaknesses were. And they learned by trying various things out. So their overreach was not, it wasn't just hubris. It was part of a process of learning what they could do correctly the next time. And I think that the left are going to have experiences, something like that. We're going to have victories. We're going to, win, for example, prominent union posts, maybe get some people elected, and they're going to face serious difficulties. And the question is not whether things blow back or you get shut down by the institutional aggression of the state or whatever, but what do you learn from it and what do you do about it? Rather than, as often happens, you get defeated and you cry into your beer for the next 4 years and don't do anything about it. You have to be ready for the defeat. You have to get war game defeat. And prepare for what you're going to do correctly next time. One thing we can say for sure is the system is extremely unstable. I'm talking about the political system, what remains of our electoral democracy. It's extremely unstable. And the idea that it's going to stabilize back around the center at any point soon, it's crazy. So we have to be ready for the possibility that, things are going to happen. Some radicals are going to be projected into positions that they didn't expect to have. And what are we going to do about it? How are we going to organize? How are we going to exploit those opportunities? Yeah, I'll leave it there. Anything else?
Thanks a lot, Richard. Working at a university, traditionally, at least in the mythology of the United States recently, like the universities have a special place in resistance. And yet, now we're under, direct attack. We're under direct financial attack, as you know. We're under direct sort of ideological, psychological attack. So do you think that the universities still have a important role to play? I mean, especially in places which are away from the major centers like Harvard and Princeton and the like. Can universities be a positive force and not get simply vilified or crushed by the right-wing propaganda machine?
Thank you. What do you think is the gap between how leftists use affective strategy to reach people who feel Democrats, leftists have left them behind, think the leftists and Dems think we're above, you know, the unwashed masses. What is the gap between leftist strategy now around that realm of things and using it, doing that well, like as opposed to, you know, politics of joy or whatever, the ham-fisted things that technocrats push onto us? Yeah, that gap.
All right, great. Thank you. We also know that on the left, some of us would be willing to make great sacrifices if we could further the cause in some way. And indeed, part of the left's trajectory in history is one where people have undergone great privation, risked their lives, you know, in order to make some dent, make some impact on the brutal system that dominates us. And in fact, if you just think more recently, think about those students getting up on the podium and they're going to be given their degree award. And they get up and they make a statement about Palestine, knowing that they're going to have their degree revoked, that they're going to be put on a blacklist, that employers are not going to want to talk to them, and they do it anyway. They know that it's not going to make a huge difference immediately, but it's part of a general assault, an attempt to delegitimize this brutality, this barbarism that we call Zionism. It's just an example of saying that, you know, the fact that people suffer material privation in and of itself does not necessarily lead them politically one way or the other. And then your question about the relationship between disaster nationalism flowing out of neoliberalism, and you're saying, well, no, isn't it more of a reaction to neoliberalism? I would say that the response has to be a little bit more dialectical than that. What I mean is, it emerges out of neoliberalism. In a way, it is its negation, but it preserves aspects of neoliberalism. And if you look at what, you know, Le Pen has talked about policy terms. If you took look at what, let's say, the Hungarian leadership, Orban, have been talking about, if you look at what Narendra Modi has been talking about, like, they've quite explicitly embraced a version of authoritarian neoliberalism. So there are aspects of neoliberalism that they're against, like the institutional structure. Those parts of neoliberalism that emerged in what you could call very roughly its progressive era, that had to do with certain basic human rights and all the rest of it, that they want to get rid of. And they don't like, or at least the northern parts of the far right don't like, the institutional expressions that have to do with globalization. But they have conserved a lot of neoliberal ideology and discourse. And the other thing to say about that is that neoliberalism is not reducible to this idea that everybody's just a rational actor and all the rest of it. Yeah, that's part of it. That's part of the sales pitch. Neoliberalism always had a strongly moralistic dimension, pro-Western civilization, pro-family values, racist. And, you know, there's a dimension of neoliberalism that, you know, built up during the 80s and 90s and has come to the fore now, which combines a kind of libertarian political economy with border controls and ethnic nationalism and IQ racism and all the rest of it. But I do think universities, despite the fact that they have been basically taken over by corporate interests, investors and what have you, insofar as they necessarily have to equip students for critical thought and prepare them for a world in which they will have to use their ability to think critically about the world and quite often get on with people from various different backgrounds, I do think that necessarily there's always going to be a point where interpolation in the sort of sense of bourgeois ideology breaks down, and you will get a certain radicalization on campuses, or at least there will be an openness that often, if you have to, like, basically work like 10 or 12 hour days to survive, where do you get the time? You know, maybe you go on the internet and disappear down a rabbit hole, but really, unless you're, you know, you've been unionized or you've got involved in a struggle, often it'd be quite difficult to be radicalized. So I do think they still have an important role. Interesting question is whether there will still be many left-wing academics left after the end of the decade, because I think they've decided that the pact that essentially they made with the 60s generation, which was you can go into the academia and have a reasonably comfortable life and make your critiques, but you're not going to make any difference, that pact is over. I think they want to drive out the left-wing academics, and particularly the Trump right, but I think the Democrats will get on board with that as well. Right. You were asking the question about when people are feeling helpless, useless, they're in danger of falling down, you know, right-wing pipelines. What are the angles of intervention? There is no single answer to that because there are so many different vectors of radicalization to the right. And we're not really going to know that that's happened often until, you know, especially if it's on the internet, until after it started to happen. I have nothing against the internet. I'm not technophobic. I use social media. Frankly, I shouldn't. But I think we over-rely on it still for things like communication, for keeping up to date with news, and frankly, for socializing. And it's kind of become a default organizing tool, and it needs to be subordinated. But I was thinking about the impotence and the sense of frustration and the moral shame of it, the feeling like I don't dare do the thing that I know that I should do. So what this shame is, the sense of impotence, is actually an expression of your isolation, an expression of the fact that you've been robbed of social power by the sort of decades of aggression against the left and against left-wing organization. And so when you talk about the revolutionary potential of people getting involved in organization, community mobilization response teams, I think that's very important. And I think it's really significant and important that you know, we start to build up some of the mutualist and cooperative infrastructures that, you know, have always existed in society, but since the 1970s have been ground down repeatedly. But the only sort of caveat I would register with that is that we also need the kind of condensation of, let's say, political experience from across a country or across a city, and the sort of historical memory, the embedded historical memory, that would once have been thought to be quite obviously embedded in a political party. To me, the political party is necessary not because it occupies the whole ecological space of organizing, but because it communicates between all the nodes. It, you know, it's a great generalizer, and I think that's one of the things that we need. And then finally, and just really quickly on this last question about effective strategy, how can we leftists deal with affect better? Marx says this somewhere in a letter to one of his correspondents, that, you know, as Marxists, we basically explain to the world what it's fighting for, right? And here in this case, I'm simply trying to explain to other people on the left and to any liberals who are interested what is tacitly involved in what you're already doing. Already, what's involved in your struggle involves trying to change people's emotional state and their sense of the horizon of possibilities. And I would just look at recent political campaigns, and, you know, because of the situation we're in, these are largely electoral campaigns. Think about Mamdani. Think about Sanders, you know, attempted insurgencies. I know Bernie Sanders isn't Sanders anymore, but, you know, we learned the limits of his politics in some ways, but he did something important. And if you think about what happened in those contexts, and think about Corbyn in the same way, there was an emotional contagion that was started. And, you know, what is an emotional contagion? It's essentially something that's already waiting to be expressed. It's people are just looking for permission to express this feeling and to do something about it, to be given something they can do. And, you know, these electoral campaigns, as, you know, whatever criticisms we have of electoralism, it's a very low-cost way of getting involved, because all you're asking people to do is go to a polling booth and vote for you. And let's say Zoran Mamdani's offer was, come out to the polling booth, vote for me, and you can fuck over Andrew Cuomo, and you'll never have to hear from him again. That's a bargain. I would take that offer. Essentially, you know, we are already in the domain of organizing people emotionally. And actually, I'll finish on this point. Go and have a read of Lukács on the question of legality in History and Class Consciousness. He says this quite explicitly, that yes, the law dominates us often in quite brutally materialist ways, but ultimately the bourgeois state's chief asset is its spiritual domination of the working class. He uses that term. Insofar as we internalize the standards and predicates of the world in which we live, which to some extent we always do, always contradictorily, then, you know, we are dominated emotionally, intellectually, spiritually by the system. But that is why it's so important for us to demonstrate through our organization, through our self-confidence, through our historical memory, through our grasp of the overall political situation, that there is an alternative, that actually, if we all get together, what is it Sanders says, if we stand together, we do actually have the tools to get it done. Thank you for listening to me. I know I've gone over, but thank you very much.
We were just listening to Richard Seymour on resentment politics. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. Richard Seymour is a writer, broadcaster, and author of numerous books, including Disaster Nationalism. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Jesse Hagopian, Winona LaDuke, Claudia De La Cruz, Arundhati Roy, and Francesca Albanese. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Richard Seymour on Resentment Politics, and for Richard Seymour's book, Disaster Nationalism, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. She's our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.
This is Bird Note. To stay fit for the skies, most birds molt and regrow their flight feathers, one at a time along each wing. For an American robin with a 17-inch wingspan, that's 19 feathers per wing, molted and regrown over 2 months, just after the nesting season each year. Now let's scale up to the wing molt of a snowy albatross, one of the largest flying birds in the world with a whopping 10 to 12-foot wingspan. The snowy albatross, formerly known as the wandering albatross, is an incredibly efficient flyer, thanks to those long, narrow wings. Sure, albatrosses may look awkward taking off, but once airborne, they can soar for hours, even days, as they forage for squid and fish on the ocean surface. A tendon locks in place in each wing, allowing them to ride the air currents with little effort or flapping. These birds are supreme gliders. With that gargantuan wingspan, it takes the large albatrosses a full year to molt, and they have to put off breeding until the next year. It's one or the other. Their long wings require a lot of upkeep, but they make the snowy albatross a true master of the wind. This episode is also available in Espanol. To learn more, start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Do you like music or do you like technology? Or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.